Nadole Clawellen? Clawen?
Shawin.
Happy Christmas. Was that good?
It was amazing. I thought I was in the presence of Matt.
Oh, that's saying something, isn't it? His Welsh is exceptional. Well, welcome to the seasonal Yuletide extravaganza. We do have quite the historical treat on offer at this very special time of the year. We're going to look at a famous figure from the past, and we have our history maestro, Jean-Marc. Who are we going to look at this evening?
Well, this person is known by many names. Vir Nachsman, Sviti Mikolaj, Baba Gishi or Chris Ledjev, Jed Miraj, Julemand Kersterman, Tamar Kerisma, Babo Natali, Daida Na Nolach, Sean Corn, Papa Noel, Chris Kringle, Father Christmas, Santa Claus or Saint Nicholas, the patron saint of Greece, Amsterdam and Moscow.
Wow, so this is the one and only Father Christmas. This is Santa Claus. Surely, I'm sure listeners are thinking, was he not just, is he not a pretend figure? Big fat man, white beard, red suit. Is he real?
Right, I think we should have a sort of caution now. All children should switch off.
Yes.
Matt, go to another room. Father Christmas is made up.
Oh.
But Saint Nicholas, who he's based on, was most certainly a real person.
Ah, interesting.
You well, can come back now, Matt.
Well, could you tell us a wee bit more about him, since he is a real historical figure?
Well, St. Nicholas was born in Myra. He was known as Nicholas of Bar. He was a very early Christian bishop. Mm. He was born in the seaport of Patara in Lycia in Asia Minor, which is today's Turkey.
Yeah.
His parents were quite rich, and they were both believers. He also had other names by which he became known, but Nicholas the Wonder Worker, and he's a patron saint of so many groups: sailors, merchants, archers, repentant thieves, children, brewers, pawnbrokers, unmarried people, wolves, and students.
And Amazon.
Yes, Amazon like him as well.
Well, that's very interesting. I want to get a fuller picture of this man, because it sounds like he has quite an interesting life, and we sort of limit him down at Christmas time. So can you tell us a bit more about him?
Yes, he was a fairly important bishop in the early church, and he's on the early list of those who attended the first Council of Nicaea in 325. His name is on the list, but it isn't right at the top. It's on the 10th line.
Okay.
Towards the end.
Is that significant?
He's about 251th, 150 first of 220
yes,
attenders. So they're on the longer lists. On the shorter list, he doesn't appear.
Yeah.
So he was important, but not that important.
Yes, that was the council that Constantine had pulled together, wasn't that right?
Yes, he brought it together to try and solve a problem in the Eastern Church, which was caused by Arianism.
Yeah.
This stated that Jesus Christ was only human and not divine.
Yes, that was a lot of... Well, that's a lot of what John 1 is that we've been looking at in church the previous weeks, hasn't it? About how Jesus is fully God and fully man.
I prefer to call him truly God and truly man.
Truly God and truly man.
But I was listening to your podcast and you're spot on.
Thanks. Yes, it's the line from Come, O Come, All Ye Faithful, isn't it? God of God, Light of Light. All that good stuff, all the songs that we sing.
Yes.
So why would you say that that's important, that Jesus is both divine and human, that he's God and man?
Well, that's a great question, and one that is really vital, because it splits Christianity apart from every other
religion
or group. That's a key thing. Jesus himself said in John 8, I should say, unless you believe I am, you will perish in your sins. And by I am, he means I am God.
Yeah.
Probably, let's have a look, four main reasons why this is important. Mm. Firstly, that the promises of the Old Testament are fulfilled in him.
Yeah.
And so you have to believe that he is the God, because it says in the scriptures that God is going to come in so many places. John, Genesis 3:15,
yeah,
where it's the seed only of the woman, not the woman and the man.
Yeah.
You've got Exodus 14 then, where you've got God coming down, Deuteronomy 3, Psalm 32, Psalm 37, Isaiah 40, chapter 9, 41. There's loads
of examples.
So many. And then, of course, in the pictures you get then showing that God is the only one who can save. Mm. That's why Jesus has to be God as well as man, is that in the scriptures it talks about that it is God who is the savior. Again, Genesis 3, Abraham, Joseph, Moses, all of those are pictures of a human being that comes to save, and yet they can't save completely, because they're pointing to one who's going to come through the line of Abraham, Joseph, and David. And then you've got the promise then, lovely, in 2 Samuel 7, about the seed of David, the son of David, who's going to come. And then you've got the sacrifices, which again show that sacrifices are important to make us right with God, but they can't clean our sin. They can't make us right. And then you've got the promise in Genesis 22, when Abraham goes up the mountain with his son Isaac, and Isaac says, we've got the wood, we've got the fire, but where's the sacrifice?
Yes.
And Abraham says, God will provide the lamb, but it's a ram.
Yeah.
And so the when John then the Baptist says, this is the lamb.
Behold the lamb.
Yeah. Who takes away the sins of the world. So it's massive. It's massive. And of course, he has to be human as well, because God can't die.
Yeah,
and he can't be a true sacrifice or substitute for human beings, because he has to be bone of our bone and flesh of our flesh, and so he has to be divine and yet also human.
So Saint Nicholas fought for this doctrine of the person of Christ, fully truly God and truly man. So could you tell us a wee bit more about him, because obviously he gives us great gifts every Christmas, but he's given us the greatest gift in terms of preserving this doctrine. So
yes, Saint Nicholas was a figure that went to the Council of Nicaea, and some accounts say that he got so angry with the representations of the Arians that he slapped across the face the main Arian proponent, and because of that he was punished. He was defrocked and put in prison. And then the myths and legends come out that there was a shaking and an angel came and put clothes on him and took him out of the place. So that's the sort of
kind of like Paul and bit. Silas and that.
Yes, it's interesting. Well, on top of that then, 200 years after his death, a church was on his place where he used to worship. And then they placed then a new church that was put there by the Roman emperor. So Theodosius put a church over where they think was the church that he worshipped in. And then the bones of Nicholas were taken away then, because there were fear of the invading hordes. So they were taken away to Bari, not Bari Island.
Yeah.
Bari in southern Italy, and enshrined there. So they put in a place there by order of the Pope then. That was Urban the First. And then during the First Crusade, they again took them away because of fear of the hordes and placed them in Venice.
Wow. There's love. Yeah. There's so much of this stuff that you're kind of like, why are people so interested in these saints and don't read their Bible?
I suppose it's easier.
Yeah,
it's easier to touch something.
Yeah,
and to hope that they're going to be fine.
Yes,
and to think and to read and of course the devil doesn't want us to.
Yeah,
and so he'll try and make us go for the easy option.
Yeah. So we're talking about Saint Nicholas. When did he become Father Christmas, or is there anything else you want to say about Saint Nicholas?
Well, the interesting things getting it up to date now is that this tomb that was in Venice remained undamaged, and it can still be seen in Italy, and Venice. And they opened the crypt up in 1953 with church restoration after the war, and the bones were moved to safekeeping, And then when they looked and examined the bones, they got an almost complete head. And they worked out that these bones belonged to a man of about 70.
Yeah.
Nicholas was supposed to be about 75 when he died. So that fits in nicely. And then in 1957, they did more examinations and they worked out that he was a really tall guy of about 5'5¾".
Oh, what a giant.
He was. I'd look up to him and Matt would look him eye in the face to face because he's there. He had a short, wide face and he ate mainly vegetables, which again would fit in with the diets of bishops in those times. And he suffered, his bones suffered from injury, which would have been conducive to confinement in a damp place. And he was kept in prison during various things there. He had a thin face, large eyes, and a big forehead.
So when did he become this Father Christmas figure?
Well, there's even more things about him.
Oh, keep going.
Even more things about him.
Sorry, I'm trying.
Want to get to Father Christmas, don't you?
I have two interests in Father Christmas. Tell us more.
Well, from his bones was oozing this white substance.
Okay, that sounds disgusting.
And they loved it, and they used to collect it in little vials and sell them. And it had healing properties. They call it myrrh. So when they examined this in 1925, they discovered it was water, that he had condensation where he was kept, and this was trickling off the skull, and then he was falling. So that was it, basically. But the Turks wanted it back, the bones of Father Christmas, and they asked in 2009, 2012, and 2013, and each time they were told no, so they couldn't have Father Christmas back. And then in 2017, following Pope Francis's talks with Russians, they agreed to send some of the bones back. So some of the bones were sent to St. Petersburg, not to Turkey.
Wow.
And there were over 1 million people lined up in Moscow to see these bones.
To see Father Christmas.
In an ark, to see these bones there. So it's quite sad, really, that they ignore Christ, but they look at these bones.
Yeah.
It's very, very strange.
Now I know why I've been so confused about why we're doing more, because I've been looking at an old script of what I thought we were doing. Now I'm back on track.
You think it's Daniel Rowlands, don't you?
Yeah.
There's no S. It's Daniel Rowland.
Yeah. So now I'm back on track. How, can I ask the question, how did he become Father Christmas? I want to know.
That's the one.
I want to become Father Christmas. I think that's the issue.
We were on page 8, folks.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the way he became Father Christmas is linked to two of the stories told about him.
Okay. The way you said stories there, are they stories?
Well, I'll tell you.
Okay.
Well, the first one is probably authentic.
Okay.
The first one, it's a story of three girls and a father and some bags of gold. Sounds like Hans Christian Andersen, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, once upon a time, well, it's probably historically authentic.
Okay.
There's nothing excessive in it, and it makes sense and it fits in perfectly. What happened was that you had these three girls and their father. They were poor. And because they were poor. So because
think about what a cat does. What does a cat do?
Poor.
Purr. That's how you say purr.
Poor, P-A-W.
No. As in like the noise that they make in their throat. Purr.
They go.
Yeah, that's purring.
Okay.
That's how you say purr.
Okay, right.
Keep going, sorry.
Right. So they had a father who didn't have much money.
Yeah.
And because he didn't have much money, the girls wouldn't be able to get married. So they'd have to have a horrible life. So he found out about this. His parents had died, so he thought he'd help out. So one night late, he went past the house and he threw a big bag of gold through the window.
Wow.
And the father...
Smashed the window?
Killed, no. No windows in those days. No windows. It was just a big hole.
Of
with
course.
Wood. It was warm, and so they had them open.
Yeah.
So the father found it, used that as a dowry. So the first daughter got married.
Grim.
A couple of weeks later, he did exactly the same thing late at night, threw another bag of gold over. Second daughter could get married. Well, the father then thought, I got to find out who this benefactor is and thank him.
Yeah.
Plus, I think there's another bag of gold on the way. I can catch him. So sure enough, he stayed up all night for about 3 nights. And then this bag of gold came over and he rushed out and he found St. Nicholas there. And St. Nicholas said, please don't tell anyone. I don't want this to get out. It's, you know, it's a donation. It's anonymous.
So he's donating because he has rich parents.
Who have died and he's got lots of money. Okay, yeah. Fine. So he wants to help.
Yeah.
And so because of that, these children, but the young women, they don't have a horrible life.
Yeah.
So that's the thing with gifts. The second story that sort of fits into Father Christmas is that there was this sort of butcher, and there was this is what I call story in inverted commas.
Okay.
He was a butcher, and the butcher was living in a time of famine, and there were these children that he enticed in, and he killed them. And he pickled them.
Okay.
And he was going to sell them bits of their bodies as pork. Now.
And these are the origins of Santa.
Well, the good thing was with St. Nicholas found out this, and he went into this place.
And
he resurrected them.
Oh, I thought that St. Nicholas was the butcher who was pickling the kids.
No, he's the hero.
He's the hero of the story who resurrected.
That's
the
why he's called Saint.
Yes, that's why I was so confused. Good grief.
There we are. So the second story is because of that. And that shows that he likes children. So you've got the muddling of the two stories.
Okay, I see.
One giving gifts because of children.
Yes.
And the other saving children from a terrible fate.
Yes,
so you put the two together and then people say, well, he likes children in a nice kind way.
Yeah, very good.
Then in Holland, then there was a Sinterklaas, and they talked about him and muddled his stories up and talked about him. And then in America, the Dutch settlers went with the story, their Protestants, about him.
I see.
And they carried on in the Middle Ages then. They used to celebrate St. Nicholas on the day they thought he died, which was the 6th of December. So they celebrated his death. Then what a great saint's day then. And they used to give gifts to children. Well, come the Reformation and Martin Luther.
Because we're going to have to get from the 6th of December to the 25th somehow.
We do. And Martin Luther is the man.
The reformers.
Yeah, he hated the saints with all their bones and arms and legs and things. And he hated them. And so he tried. Well, he was half successful. He moved, first of all, the day of venerating St. Nicholas to the 25th of December.
Yeah.
And then he tried to replace St. Nicholas with the Christkind, with the Christ child.
Oh, I see.
That's what he tried to do. And he was only partly successful because everyone liked giving gifts. And so St. Nicholas carried on, and then the day was changed to the 25th.
I see.
And then the interesting thing was in Britain then,
You've
got Henry VIII. And at that time, they used to celebrate Father Christmas with people dressing in green. They had green robes.
Yes. I know how he changed from green to red. It's
Robin Hood.
It's Coca-Cola, isn't it?
I don't know.
Well, that's why I've heard that Coca-Cola changed him from green to red.
Oh,
red's much more festive.
Right. I heard that it was the Americans.
Yeah.
When they adopted it and changed him from being a thin man with big eyes, being a chubby man with red face and a sleigh and reindeer, and they made him wear red because they had red in their flag.
Yes, 1931, Coca-Cola changed him from green to red. So Coca-Cola are American. So
together
our stories merge. It's kind of like the pickling story and the other one.
Isn't it?
Comes together and it works.
It's the Americans we have to thank.
Yeah.
And they obviously made him live in the North Pole with reindeer and
all that good stuff,
which is what we love.
So what lessons can we learn from St. Nicholas? Like, obviously we see the care and the love for children who are going to awful fates. Anything else?
I think the first lesson is you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. No, that's not a real lesson.
That's often the picture that non-Christians have of God, isn't it?
It is. It is, very sadly. So firstly then, our lives are only fully known by God. St. Nicholas is a saint, is a Christian, and his life is muddled in mystery, legend, embellishments.
Yeah.
But the Lord knows him and knows his ways and knows where he is now.
Yeah.
And loves him and cares for him. And it doesn't matter what people say about him now or think about him.
Yeah.
God knows the solid foundation of God stands firm, having this seal that God knows his elect.
Yeah.
And this is a great comfort for us who are Christians who aren't great in the world and aren't known.
No.
But the Lord's eye is on us. So that'll probably be the first lesson.
Yeah.
Secondly, then, there's another encouragement, is that God's people are precious to him.
Mm.
He watches us over and cares for us. So as St. Nicholas was watched over and cared for by God, and whatever he did in secret, God rewards him openly and rejoices in him, my good and faithful servant. And so it's an encouragement to us to keep working, not as men pleasers, but as bond servants doing the will of God from our heart.
Yeah.
So it's an encouragement, because again, from the first story with the three girls, he told the father, don't tell anyone. And of course it got out, and we know what happened then. And then another encouragement is that how wonderful it is to be a Christian, because we can be sure of Jesus Christ, that Jesus of Nazareth, the historical person, is the Christ, the Saviour. And unlike St. Nicholas, whose life is vague and shadowed in mystery and uncertainty and doubt, Jesus Christ's history is clear and shining like a sun in the firmament.
Yeah, that's the encouragement, isn't it? We might be speculating with some of this St. Nicholas stuff, but the gospel accounts are very clear about who he is. Mm. So could you tell us a little bit more about who Jesus is then, this historical figure?
Right, well, on page 10 I've got, what would you say we can know about who Jesus is then?
Yeah.
That's an awful question I've written in it. It's awful, much better the way you said it. But the first reason is that the gospel accounts are very clear about who Jesus is. There's no doubt. They start off, Mark starts off very clearly that Jesus is the Christ. This is the gospel of the Son of God.
Yeah.
Matthew, again, he got the line all the way back. Luke does the same. He goes even further back
right
at the beginning. And John goes further back than even Luke.
As we've seen, to the beginning.
It does, right to the beginning there, Genesis 1:1. So the accounts are very clear that he is God the Son, equal with the Father and the Spirit, and that he's humbled himself by becoming a servant, obeying God the Father to fulfill the law, and that he humbles himself and becomes human, truly God, truly man, and then he humbles himself further to die as a substitute on the cross. It's Philippians 2. Mm. So we can see that in the Gospels very, very clearly. And we can know who Jesus is, where he came from, what he did, why he did what he did, and where he is now. Things that we don't know about St. Nicholas, and people may not know about us in years to come, but basically the person and work of the Lord Jesus Christ is crystal clear in the Gospels.
So someone might ask you, you know, St. Nicholas, Jesus, Santa, how can you know who Jesus is? Because is it not the same sort of speculation as we have with St. Nicholas? How would you know who Jesus is?
Well, the number of reasons. First reason, if you go to the Old Testament, which was written a long time before Christ, there are pictures of him in there. They're the symbols, sacrifices, the models, the types of saviors, priests, prophets, and kings that are going to describe a person who is yet to come into the world. You know, we mentioned Genesis 3:15, which you've got the first promise there. Adam and Eve, they've sinned in the garden. They're going to be cast out. And the word, the voice of God in the garden, promises that there will be a saviour, the seed of the woman. There's a promise that somebody miraculous is going to come, but it's going to be a seed of the woman. And then we're told later on then that this seed of the woman is coming through the line of Abraham. And then we're told then that he's going to come through history to save his people. And then we're told that Moses comes, and that God came down through Moses to save, and that a prophet like unto Moses shall arise. And then we've got all the sacrificial system, which is all odd. Where you have to put your hand on an animal and confess your sin, and the animal dies in your place. But they know that they've got to sacrifice another animal for another sin. And so there's sort of forgiveness, but it's not continual.
Yeah.
And so it's pointing then to somebody who is going to take away sin continually forever from us. And then there's the wonderful thing then that Moses couldn't take his people into the promised land, but Joshua could.
Yeah.
And of course, Joshua is Jesus
in
Hebrew. So you've got those, and then you've got all the promises then through the Old Testament that you've got all these judges, that God raises up a judge and saves the people, and then the judge dies, and then the people go back to sin, and then another judge is risen, and then they save the people. So the message there is that we need a judge that lives forever.
Yeah, a better judge.
At the Son of Righteousness. And then you've got Malachi then, that the Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in his wings. Now, the people in the Gospels knew these promises. And when they saw Jesus, they realized that the promises were fulfilled in him. There was a woman with the issue of blood, and she knew the promise in Malachi that the Son of Righteousness shall arise with healing in his wings. So she knew if she touched the hem of his garment, she would be healed.
Yeah.
Because the hem of the garment was called the wings.
I see.
Of the garment. So she knew if she touched him,
that's
there was
helpful.
Healing. And so she touched him, and power went out from him. And he didn't want this to be done secretly. He said, well, who touched me?
Yeah.
So it was. So you've got the promises in the Old Testament, the types, the symbols, which show that someone's going to come. And the chances of one person fulfilling all those types and promises and prophecies in the Old Testament, probably, they said, just the prophecies would be the same likelihood as if you got £1 coin and took it up in a helicopter over Wales, and you filled Wales with pound coins to the height of 8 foot. So the whole of Wales now is full of coins, pound coins, eight foot. And you paint this coin red, you drop it from a helicopter blindfolded. The chance of you finding that coin would be the chances of one person fulfilling just 39 prophecies in the Old Testament. Oh, and of course, there's so much there. So the first way I'd say the Old Testament prophecies, promises, symbols, pictures, sacrifices, types, show. And then, of course, there's the signs that Jesus did.
In his own life, when he was on earth.
In his own life, because they knew in the scriptures that when the Saviour would come, if God came, he'd have signs. In Isaiah 35, then shall the eyes of the blind be opened. And then he talks about the deaf hearing, the lame leaping for joy. And when John is in prison and his disciples are still hanging around him, I don't think John is doubting. I think John is saying, why are you with me? You should be with Christ.
Yeah.
So he sends them to Christ because they say, are you the Christ, or should we wait? They use the word we, not should I. It's not John.
Yeah, should we wait for another?
And of course, Jesus says, tell him what you see. And he gives them the signs from Isaiah.
Yeah.
You see the lame leaping, the blind seeing.
The only one that they don't give is the captive is set free, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. It's really amazing. And of course, the signs that Jesus did publicly, he sent them, the blind man. Particularly, they didn't like that. They cast him out of the synagogue. They didn't want a blind man because they knew it was a sign. And when he cured the lepers, he sent them to the priests. They didn't like that either.
No.
And when they said, give us a sign, he said, only one sign you'll get. And that's the sign of the resurrection.
Yeah.
Jonah being raised. And so it shows again that, how do we know that who Jesus that really is? God and man in one person. You've got his signs.
So that's a lot of evidence from the Bible, from the scriptures. Would you say that there are good reasons to believe who Jesus is based on historical ground?
Yes. People would say you're reasoning circular. You're saying the Bible is proving the Bible. Well, yes, but if you look at the source, if you look at the scriptures and how reliable the scriptures are, you can see that you can trust them. And in a number of ways that you can see that the scriptures are really reliable. The first one is that you've got the historical record, that it's extremely early.
Yeah.
The testimonies you've got are very early. Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, the earliest account we've got of him is about 200 years after his birth and death.
Yeah.
But with Jesus Christ, the accounts of him are much earlier. The complete account we've got of St. Nicholas doesn't come till the 9th century. So you're talking about 600 years later.
That's quite a long time.
It's a long, long time afterwards. And that's very vague and fragmented and uncertain. But with Jesus, you've got the account of his life, his death, his resurrection, about 15 years after his death.
Wow.
And his resurrection. And the manuscripts, there are so many copies and fragments of them that go back very early that are exactly what we've got in our New Testaments, obviously translated from the Greek, but they're very accurate. I think the earliest one they've got is a fragment in John Ryland's library, or John, where it's written on both sides. Christians were the first to write on both sides of the parchment. Mm. And on one side, you've got Pilate saying, "What is truth?" And that's the one we've got. And they say it's between 90 AD and 125. It's around there. So it's very, very early. But the accounts of Jesus that we've got in the Gospels, within 15 years or so of his resurrection.
So that is quite an early date. So how could you explain how you get such an early date for these things?
Right, okay. It's an early date based on the work of Luke, the historian. In his book then, he says that other accounts had been written of Jesus.
Yes, and he set out to write an orderly account.
That's it. He said that the other ones had been written, but they'd been written in such a way as to give a sort of thematic or structured account. And if you look at the two Gospels before Luke in our Bible, there's Matthew and there's Mark.
Yeah.
So it's those are the two that he's referring to. Mm. And they're in the Bible, I think, because that was in the order that they were written.
Yeah.
But not the order of size or anything like that. Now, if you see that Matthew and Mark were used and known about by Luke, you've also got the fact then that Luke also wrote Acts. And Acts ends before Paul and Peter die. Mm. So Peter dies between 64 and 68. Paul dies between 62 and 66. Mm. So it was written before then. So Acts was written before, say, 66. Yeah. So Luke must have been written before that, because the second volume, because he starts off the same in my first account. So it's... it must be before. Then you see then that Paul quotes from Luke's gospel.
Yes, because they were traveling companions, weren't they? Mm.
He knew him and he worked with him and he helped him as a sort of physician.
Yeah.
It's belief, I think, that Luke, Paul had problems with his eyes. Mm. That's what I can see. So having a doctor, physician with you would be helpful. And he wrote these things down. And he quotes from 1 Corinthians about... a labourer worthy of his hire. Mm. And he quotes that from Luke. And 1 Corinthians was written between 53 and 54 AD. Mm. So Luke must have been written before then.
Yes, for him to quote it.
For him to quote it, of course. And then, obviously, in 1 Timothy 5, he also quotes the Old Testament Luke there, talking about... stuff, and he calls it scripture. So it must have been around some time before that. So if Jesus died and rose around 33, then you've got 53 to 54 when Paul knows that this gospel is about and uses it. So it must have been around to be accepted for him to quote it in the same vein as Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
So you're talking at least 5-6 years for it to have got around.
Yes.
So you're talking about 15 years, I'd say.
But even as you say that, like in our modern era, people are like, well, 6 years is a long time. But in those days, that's a very short amount of time for these documents to be coming out, isn't it, by comparison, would you say?
Oh gosh, it's you want documents to be written by eyewitnesses, and you want people to be able to test them and check them.
Yeah.
And the people who test and check them were the people who were eyewitnesses. In Old Testament history, sorry, New Testament history, and historians of the first and second century, the way that they would assess a historical document for accuracy would be, was it written by eyewitnesses in the time of eyewitnesses, and were other eyewitnesses able to contest or correct it?
Yes, because that's the one of the other reasons for the historical existence of Jesus, isn't it? That the eyewitnesses. Mm. Are there any other reasons to accept the historical existence of Jesus?
Yes, that you've got, first of all, you've got that section there about the Gospels being extremely accurate because they were early. Then you've got the fact then that there are lots of sections. It's not like we're relying on one document.
There's
500. They're about around 6,000 fragments of Gospel bits, and when they read them, they tie in perfectly. You can see, you got four sentences. Oh, I know where this is from.
Yeah.
Or there's half a sentence. Oh, I can tell where this comes from. It's amazingly accurate and important. They had all sorts of groups of people that said that different Gospels were written later. John, they said, was written. The German critics in the 19th century hated the Gospel of John and said, oh, it was written in the 3rd, 4th century. It was so deep. And then they found the Diatessaron, which was a sort of amalgamation of all the Gospels.
Yeah.
And it began in the beginning, was the word. Yeah. And that was written in 175. So that really floored them.
Yeah.
And destroyed so much scholarship, in inverted commas. And then, of course, the John Rylands manuscript came, which was 50 years at least earlier than that, so they have problems. So you've got the bibliography or the bibliographical data, the huge number of manuscript fragments that back up what you can test and check and see that the source is right. Then you've got the fact then that these Gospels and Acts are primary sources themselves. Matthew, Mark and John are all primary sources, and that they're all witnesses.
Yeah.
Matthew was one of the apostles, so was John. Mark, his mother looked after the upper room.
Yeah.
And he was probably, they think, the man that ran away at the end.
Yeah, when naked. Yes. Yeah, because it's just so random to have a naked man running away.
So he's in there as well, and then he works on then. So you've got those. But they also interviewed people that were there, you know. Joseph was obviously interviewed for the beginning of Matthew there, and Mark interviews people. And when these people are interviewed, it's really interesting because you've got these random names of people that are there. And you're thinking, why are they random names? And then in the letters as well, you know, Paul in Romans says, this is a list of people that are with me. And he mentions them. And you think, why are these names there?
Yeah.
And of course, when you cross-reference with the Gospels, you can see, I understand why this woman's mentioned.
Yeah.
Because her husband was in Herod's temple. And if he was working for Herod, then they'd know what Herod was saying. So they'd know that Herod said, I want the head of John the Baptist on a platter.
Yes.
And they'd know about Salome. And you're thinking, I can see the names.
The so links,
The primary sources are really, really important. Then the way you get a manuscript as a historian is you test it. You test it with everything you can see. Is it accurate? Does it tell you any information, and can you check it? But all the geographical information in the Gospels, going up places, distances, the names of places, the types of trees there, the grass, the seasons, they're perfect.
So everything checks out?
Everything checks up geographically, history, archaeologically. There's a chap, Borkum, and he's written a book on the witnesses.
Is Jesus and Eyewitnesses? Yeah.
That's it.
Jesus. I have it. Yeah. Have. It's good.
It's very good. Well, he goes through it and it's brilliant. He works out, you know, the names and titles of people and stuff. Languages then. There's Peter Williams. He's written a little book on Can We Trust the Gospels?
Yes, I have that as well. He was recently at Highfields doing something on this. Yeah.
He's brilliant.
He's very good.
Brilliant. And he talks about how accurate they are, and he talks about the language and the style of the sermons. And really everything that can be tested and checked out has been checked out and tested and hasn't been found wanting. So it's brilliant.
Can you give us any examples of where we've done examples, haven't we, of areas that have been tested, the geography, historically, archaeologically, languages, all that?
Yes, and more. Well, Richard Bourke, historically, he's done a lot on the names. It's really funny. It's things that are really obvious now.
Yeah.
And we think, oh, I should have thought of that. He did a study on the graves and the little tombs, little pots, the little, I forgot what they're called now, the little pots that they keep bones, ossuaries, the bone ossuaries.
I wouldn't have been able to help you there.
What happened was when you died, they put you in a tomb.
Yeah.
And then they'd leave you there for a couple of years. Your flesh would go.
Okay.
And then they'd collect your bones and put it in a little box called an ossuary. And then they'd put you on a shelf in the family tomb. So you'd have all these little bone boxes, ossuaries, around the place. And when they found the graveyard, the tombs, there were inscriptions on the bone boxes, the names of the people that were there.
Yeah.
So he could get a list of the most popular names in Judaism and in Israel at that time. And it's really interesting because then when he looked through the Gospels, he could work out the most popular names there as well.
I see.
And so you found that Simon or Joseph was 15.6% of people were named that in Jerusalem at the time, and Gospel and Acts, it's 18.2%.
So it's highlighting the fact that it wasn't just like, I don't know, if you're reading a gospel account and you came across like a 21st century name, like something totally out of the blue, you'd be like, what's that doing there? But it all matches up with names used at the time.
And it's really interesting because even in Egypt, not too far away at that time, the most popular names were not the names in the Gospels. Okay. They were completely different
sets. Because it's in Egypt,
Because it's an Egyptian set. So it's really very interesting. Plus the other interesting things that he's got, you've got disambiguators. So when you've got people with the same name, you'll have something else to separate them. Now, because Simon was popular, every time you have a Simon, they put something at the end. Simon the Zealot, Simon the Tanner. Simon Peter.
Yes, because there's Judas Iscariot and there's another Judas, wasn't there?
Yeah, Judas not Iscariot.
Yeah.
So it's really quite interesting. And the thing I found really interesting then is that Peter Williams goes further and he says, you notice this with Jesus. Because when Jesus is in a crowd situation, no one shouts out, Jesus, Jesus. Because 50 or 60 people would turn around and said, So they use the disambiguate to say, Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus, son of David.
Yeah.
So it's really, and then as soon as they've identified who Jesus is, they just call him Jesus because we know who we're talking about.
Yes. Whenever I go out in places, people shout David of Temple Patrick and I go, oh, that's me, of course. Or David of Northern Ireland. Whereas, you know, if you just started David, there'd be countless people who'd turn around.
When I go, nobody shouts.
There's not many Jean-Marc, surely.
No, they're not.
There's only one.
Yes. There's probably another one somewhere.
No.
No, maybe not. Right, so historically, these names with David Bourke, they're amazingly, amazingly accurate.
Yeah.
And it shows then that they're not made up.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Then geographically, then you've got the names of the places. Timothy McGrew has looked at this, and he's looked at how many times in the Gospels a place is named. Odd places, little places, not very important places.
Yeah.
And they're named quite regularly. And yet when you've got the false Gospels,
they don't mention any of that.
I think they mention Bethlehem once, but they think it's the name, the surname of Mary in one of the false Gospels. So it's very interesting that you've got the accuracy there. Archaeologically then, archaeology is a great friend to Christians and the Jewish faith because they're constantly finding things. The big one was obviously finding the five pools. The porticos, they said, oh, Jesus, never were there, it was made up. And then they did some kind of archaeological work, and then they found the five pools. It's really interesting. Another one they found about 3-4 years ago was a boat on the Sea of Galilee, and it was preserved, and they had a big lump at the stern, which they called the pillow. So when Jesus was asleep in the stern with his head on the pillow,
I see.
He was on this block of wood.
Yes,
which was
good.
Really, really interesting. And then we've got Peter Williams. He talks about the languages.
Yeah.
And he has a very interesting case. He says that he thinks that Jesus, in huge group situations, spoke Greek because that was the common language that most people would understand.
Yeah.
And the reason he says that is that when you look at the Sermon on the Mount in Greek, you can see that he uses alliteration and similes all the way through, which you wouldn't have got if he translated it from Hebrew.
Yeah.
So everything is so, so interesting and fits in so wonderfully.
So any Christmas presents people should be getting for future reading on St. Nicholas or about Jesus?
Right, well, I think the first two, obviously, is Clement Clark Moore's "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." That's a must, to buy. And then a must to watch are the Santa Claus movies with Tim Allen.
You love them.
There are three of them, and they're brilliant. And they've done a sort of like a series now as well on Disney Plus of six episodes called The Escape Clause.
So get watching those.
He's very good. He's very funny. Very funny. But then the two books that I sort of mentioned, then Richard Baucom is very good.
Yeah.
Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. He's got 2006, it first came out, but in 2017, they got an update with more stuff in it, so that's worth getting. And then a smaller little book is Peter J. Williams, Can We Trust the Gospels? Crossway. It's a tutty little thing. It's only how many pages? Let's have a look.
It's an easy read as well. It's not dense.
He's written it brilliantly. It's 140 pages. 140 pages. It's lovely.
There's a book to get someone who is questioning these things or wants to know how to answer tricky questions.
Or just something wonderful to read. It's very good.
Yeah, you're allowed just to read it because you want to read it.
And he's a Williams as well, so he must be Welsh.
Yeah, and must be good.
He is.
So I'll say Nadolig Llywelyn. Clowen. I don't know why I say Clowen. That's a place, isn't
it? Clowen. Yes.
Yeah. Nadolig Clowen.
And I'd say Merry Christmas in Gaelic, but I don't know any Gaelic.
That's okay.
So
Happy Christmas. Hope you enjoyed this special. What is it? Festive?
Festive treat.
Yeah, festive treat. Very good.